This is the Beat Your Genes podcast, and my name is Nate G. I created this podcast to bridge together the science of evolutionary psychology and the clinical experience of Dr. Doug Lyle, all so that we can discover what life is all about. In each episode, Dr. Lyle analyzes and explains the psychology behind real-life situations from our listeners on topics like romance, friendship, work, family, health, and many more. We broadcast live every Wednesday at 8:30 p.m. Pacific Standard Time, which means you can call us during the show and ask Dr. Lyle a question. The U.S. number is 657-383-0751, or send in your question through the website www.beatyourgenes.org. All right. Good evening, everybody. It's Nate G, along with Dr. Doug Lyle, the Beat Your Genes podcast. We broadcast live every Wednesday, 8:30 p.m. Pacific Standard Time. Dr. Lyle, how are you doing tonight?
Good, good. Good to hear your voice again.
Excellent. All right. So last week, we had a very interesting set of questions and had a good time answering some of those. I'm sure you were, Dr. Lyle, right?
I don't and, even remember. The sexual harassment stuff, I remember.
Yeah.
I think I remember that. Got it.
And then, so we ended the show with a question about how to, you know, what's the best way to know, or what do you do with the high anxiety to know when it's time to get with the program and what's the best approach to this? And so we ended the show with that question. You answered that question beautifully, as always. And so we move on to the next few questions that we had last week, and they have the first set of questions have to do with eating a health promoting diet. So we're just going to get right down to it. So, dear Dr. Lyle, I've been eating a whole foods plant based healthy diet, salt, oil, sugar free diet for a couple of years, and some people have accused me of being orthorexic, and I'm starting to believe that they might be right. After all. I'm afraid of oil. I'm afraid of processed foods. I'm afraid of salt. I'm afraid of pretty much everything that everybody eats. I know that once I start on it, I won't stop and it'll make me feel sick. What are your thoughts? I just know that I can't have that stuff or I'll binge or overeat and I'll feel awful about myself. Is that really that bad? Is that orthorexia? And if it is, or if it's not, do you believe in the term orthorexic?
Okay. First of all, this person, obviously highly conscientious, really trying to do a superb job with respect to their diet. I don't believe that an SOS-free plant, whole plant diet is the only diet that is excellent. I believe that it may be the best thing or some combination very close. Some combinations of those things may be best, but this person has did not come about this. The reason I say this is that they didn't arrive here by accident. There's been a lot of reading, a lot of thinking. They've listened to a lot of people, and this makes the most sense to them. Now, it's also the case that they have identified a truth about themselves, which is that this is a struggle for them to stay on a very healthy diet if they include oil and other processed foods. Oil itself is obviously a processed food. And so processed foods are not evil. It's just that they have there's a tendency for processed foods to be have an addictive-like quality to them, basically because of the food processing, they will hyperactivate the dopamine pathway in many cases. And so they can activate an addictive-like pattern of behavior where people can have a great deal of time exercising restraint. And in this case, so this person is not alone. Very many people, if they eat, I mean, literally, let's go back to the ads, you know, Lay's potato chips, I'll bet you can't eat just one. Not only can you not eat just one, you cannot stop yourself from finishing the whole sack. So this is completely... this is completely reasonable on the person's part to be. What's that?
That's why I always buy two bags.
Okay. Yeah, one for a friend, right? So anyway, this is not this is not an unreasonable level of conscientiousness. It's just an unusual level of conscientiousness. Now, when the person says, I think they said they fear the food, etc. The there isn't anything to fear from processed food. It's just that we know that it's a problem. We know that it's a problem that once you get into it, there's an addictive-like process. It can be difficult to get yourself out of it and essentially stay on a healthy path. It can definitely be a pathway to contributing to excess weight, et cetera, et cetera. So it's not going to close out your life, and it's not going to be some unmitigated disaster. This isn't heroin addiction we're talking about. But for an individual, it can. What we're looking at is it can take your life down from an 8 to a 6, and that's no small thing. It may take your life down to the life of more average people that aren't this fastidious and that are walking around 30 pounds overweight and their skin isn't very good and they've got joint pain and they've got little creeping problems, et cetera. And that's just sort of how life is, and that's what they do. That isn't anything terrible to fear, but at the same time, it's not anything to emulate either. And so this individual is doing, is attempting to do a stellar job. Now, other people will say, you know, some shrink might call this orthorexic, i.e., you've got, you know, overly sensitive about, you know, eating these foods. And God forbid my friends and colleagues at the APA are going to start thinking that anybody that has a problem with a ham sandwich, unless you're Jewish, you know, has something wrong with you. Now, the truth of the matter is that this is just very high conscientiousness. And now, undoubtedly, there are people that can get so concerned about every little scrap and morsel of their food and wondering if it's, what do you call it, organic and whether or not it's ever touched, you know, something that could be problematic. You know, this is, you can get to the point where you're actually OCD, to where there is the anxiety that's associated with any imperfections in your food can be dominating your life to the point where this is an unbelievable hassle. At that point, what you're looking at, you're essentially looking at OCD about this issue. What I'm hearing this person describe at this point doesn't rise to this level. My friend Alan Goldhammer would just say this person's intelligent and has a lot of diligence and et cetera. So there are, the question is, are there upsides? What's that?
He might even invite them dinner, or actually no, invite them to True North.
I don't think so. Yeah, only at True North. The but the point is that no, this isn't unreasonable. It's just orthorexic, I would say, for me, would get to the level of where people are obsessing about little tiny variances in the content of what foods that they're eating, whether or not it's organic or not, with pesticides, whether or not a knife that may have touched some animal flesh, and now in that restaurant we can't go there because it's not a vegan thing, et cetera. You can essentially overanalyze these risks, but a person that is worried about eating processed food and trying to stay on a healthy track and doesn't want to get into it and worries about defending themselves against those temptations, that is not an unreasonable bunch of thinking. It's just an unusual bunch of thinking. And so, you know, I don't think that there's anything wrong with that. All right, let's go on.
All right, and okay, so next question.
Yeah.
This is from the same person. So I'm actually going on a first date, and I'm apprehensive to tell the male that I'm a vegan and that I don't drink. I'm afraid he'll think that I'm weird. I'm a young social girl in her 20s, and I go out to bars and whatnot. I just really don't like drinking. What should I do when he asks why I'm not drinking? I don't want to scare him off.
Okay. Well, if you're different, you're different. And the truth is that this person is different. This is a very high conscientious young woman who does not want to be fat and sick and out of shape and have a bunch of associated health problems and psychological fallout from not taking care of herself in a tip-top fashion. In addition, she doesn't happen to be interested in drinking, which is completely fine. And any male that would be turned off by the fact that you don't drink is kind of somebody that we're not interested in. That's somebody that's not grown up enough to know that there is no necessity of having a good time if you're not using alcohol. You can go to the bar, you can hang with the people, you can drink pineapple juice, which is what I've done, and other such things. If anybody ever asks me why I don't drink, I just tell them, I'm just never into it. Very simple. We don't have to make any case about it. We signal by being there and being laid back about it that we are not being judgmental at all. Okay. Now, my friend Alan Goldhammer.
Dr. Goldhammer, is he the guy who made the video "How to Get Along Without Going Along"? That's Dr. Goldhammer, right?
That was me doing mitigating all of the collateral social damage done by Alan. Alan would mince no words if anyone would cross-examine him about alcohol. He'd say, "Because I don't want to kill a bunch of brain cells, get sick, and die." There's different ways to handle this. I would just I would do what I have done my whole life. I have never done any drinking, and from the time I was 16 years old, I was at places where everybody else was drinking. And as long as you have a smile and you're relaxed and you have something in your hand and you're not making any issue at all about what anybody else is doing, then they pick up signals that you're not actually being judgmental, which I never was. And so as a result of that, I think he cares more about your shape and your face than he cares about whether or not you're drinking. So don't sweat it.
Mm-hmm.
All right.
So a question along the same line.
Oh, yeah, he cares a little bit about your personality, but not a lot.
Yeah. Along the same vein, what about the people who cross-examine you and feed you wrong information, like, you're looking like you're too skinny, or are you sure this is going to be, are you sure you're not taking this to an extreme, et cetera.
Yeah, you just say, you could be right. I'm just going to see how it goes. Just completely blow it off. In other words, we're going to acknowledge that they may have a point, but I'm just kind of seeing how this goes for a while. I'll look at that later. Just kick it down the road. That's how we handle things. There's nothing as effective as just kicking the can down the road and not dealing with it at the time. It's a very effective method for dealing with all kinds of problems, including that one.
Okay.
All right.
Fantastic.
What else we got?
Next question. This is from one of our longtime listeners. Dear Dr. Lyle, thank you for your insight. Get right to the question. Why do the memories of wrongdoing done to us play constantly in the background of our thoughts?
Okay. Well, first of all, they don't. Okay, so I've had all kinds of things done wrong to me, and I never think about them. So this person is reporting on some an issue or a number of specifics that may rattle through their mind. Now, the question is as to why this would happen. The reason for the action of the mind at all is always cost-benefit analysis. So the mind is running a cost-benefit analysis, including on whether or not it's worth taking the time to essentially utilize the brain's work abilities to analyze circumstances that have taken place or analyze situations and see whether or not it is worth the energy to essentially improve the individual's likelihood of gene survival by using the energy in this fashion in terms of analyzing the person's, the incidents where wrong has been done. Now, the question would be, why might that be true? Well, the first thing that comes to mind, obviously, is that we're designed by nature to remember the perpetrator that cheated us, screwed us over, treated us wrong, etc. So we're designed to not forget that specific individual. And so, essentially, we were surprised and felt cheated or mistreated in some situation. So we're going to try to analyze that person's motivation, trying to understand whether or not this was a personality issue or this was a set of circumstances that arose to this conflict of interest, and why it is that we were then treated in a way that surprised us. So so there's couple of things. Number one, we never want to forget the perpetrator. Because if they did it to us once, there's a very good chance that they could do it to us again, and a good chance that they could do it to somebody that we care about again. And so therefore, we're going to find ourselves not only ruminating about them, but also telling our important people in our village all about the circumstances, the individual, what they did, describe them, name them, et cetera, okay? So we are warning our village as well as remembering ourselves so that we don't walk into the same type of trap twice with the same individual. Now, but along the lines of the cost-benefit analysis of the energy expended on this analysis, a big reason why there are sometimes unfinished business from childhood, could be from a divorce, could be from adolescence, could be from some time we got fired, could, you know, et cetera. Some romance that went sideways 15 years ago, and there's something about it that still is sticking in our craw. Now, let's talk about why this sometimes happens. So this seems to be the type of thing that is happening to the individual that asked this question. The reason why this can be true is that the brain cannot figure out why it happened. So this is what I'm going to call an open loop. Now let's explain, I'm going to explain why it is that the mind would sometimes devote an inordinate amount of energy over years to go back and continue to analyze some wrongdoing that happened to us, and keep turning it over in our mind. First of all, the loss from the wrongdoing could not be trivial. It had to be substantial, or we would not be ruminating about it. So we're not going to worry about the time when somebody screwed us out of $50. That's not going to be the issue. It will have been a much bigger loss, and even though we may have gone way past those losses in the future, and that loss is in the rearview mirror, it's still bugging us why that loss happened, because it was substantial at the time. And the reason why we would ruminate over this is because there's something about the situation that we do not understand. And if we do not understand it, then we recognize intuitively that we're vulnerable to making the same mistake again. There's some reason why it is we were in those circumstances, we had the conflict of interest that we did, and that circumstances played out the way that they did, and we wound up with a major loss. The question is, why on earth did we wind up with that major loss? So the mind goes back and does Monday morning quarterbacking and tries to think through what were the set of decisions that gave rise to this. And it will attempt to do this for a while, and then it may fail to actually figure it out. And it may just sort of assign this to some negative personality characteristics of the perpetrator, but it walks away with a vague sense of disquiet, because the truth is that it knew enough about the perpetrator to not believe that was going to happen. It's like, you know, your best friend, you lend him a bunch of money, you thought he was going to do right, and then he turns around and sues you for something. It's like, what happened there? Okay, I didn't see that coming. And the problem is when I go back and look at it, I believe that I would make the same mistake again, because I don't see why this happened. This is why people will ruminate about things. So one of the most exciting things in my career is I once in a while will have one of these. So the Freudians think these things are everywhere, and it all has to do with, you know, deep problems of your childhood and unfinished business and all this kind of BS. That's not true. But there is once in a while where somebody really does ruminate about some problem. And when they do ruminate about that problem, what that is an open loop. Okay? And that open loop, they essentially don't know how to solve the problem. They still don't know how to solve the problem. And they feel very vulnerable about walking into a very similar situation in the future and experiencing another loss because essentially they lost and they also lost the lesson. They did not learn the lesson. Okay? So the brain still will scan back over there every once in a while and say, have we learned anything new about humans? Have we learned anything about that perpetrator? Have we learned anything about that kind of situation? Is there any new light we can shed on that ancient issue? Can we figure it out? And when they can't do it, they'll grind on it for a little while, and then they'll go away from it for a while, and then they'll come back again. Now, as I was going to say, one of the most exciting things that I've done in my history as a psychologist is I have sometimes cracked the mystery of some of these obsessions. And in fact, I've done it with fairly high percentage chance of success. So I don't know how many of these have been brought to me, maybe 20, and I've nailed a bunch of them. And I know what I'm looking for. In other words, I'm looking for a mistake in the person's analysis of the situation about how the loss took place, why it took place, what the factors were, and I'm looking for the mistaken inferences that they could have made about the decisions that they were making at the time. And so I step them through step by step. I need to know very, very carefully why they made each little part of the decision that they made as best they can remember. And very often I will be able to find a thread of where the mistake was. And when I'm able to find the mistake, then I'm able to shed light on that mistake, and then we can wind up with a significant breakthrough and then a resolution of this issue, and then the rumination about this thing is gone. So I told the story about the lady a long time ago with the rosacea.
And, with the rosacea so that, and the lady with the child who the train hit.
Yes, that's another one. I had another one where I had a person who had been married to their high school sweetheart, and then in their mid-20s, they broke up. The sweetheart broke up with them. And so that was hard on this young lady. And 15 years later, I'm speaking with her. And she's now 40, and she knows that he's gone on and remarried and has a couple of kids and lives 3,000 miles away. And she really has not moved on. And so she's still thinking of him all the time. She dreams about him, and she really can't get into any new relationships with anybody else, just not really interested. And this goes on literally for 15 years. And so I listen to this, and I listen to the process of how the breakup and divorce took place. They were very good friends. She was essentially completely confused as to why it is that she got dumped. And she did not quite believe it, didn't understand it, and wasn't really sure 15 years later that he really meant it and that it was really the way it really was. In other words, she didn't have closure on this, and her brain kept spinning around and around in a circle, confused about this. And I told her, you got to go see him. And I said, you've got to close the loop. And so she got in her car, and she drove several thousand miles, and she met him. And within minutes, the loop was shut. In other words, she could see he had moved on. They were in a different space. She really was fine. She said it was wonderful. It was a great time. They talked. They had a nice talk. And she walked away from there, and it was done. So that's an example of the system had not achieved closure, and for one reason or another, by getting herself right in front of that of the individual involved, was able to somehow compute all this, and it all made sense, and she was fine. So that's the answer to the question of why do the memories replay and replay and replay. The answer is because there's an open loop and the system believes that it is worth the energy to continue to run the analysis because it believes that there is genetic survival and reproductive gold sitting in that analysis and it's worth mining it, okay? So you must mine it to close the loop, and sometimes it helps to have somebody that knows their way around the mines, inside the mind. And if you walk that walk with me, we've got a shot at it. If we walk it with Sigmund Freud or his followers, you're in a lot of trouble. All right.
Okay.
Let's move on.
All right. We've got a caller on hold, so let's bring him on.
Okay, very good.
Caller, what's your name? Where are you calling from? Welcome to the Beat Your Gene podcast, Dr. Lyle.
Yes.
Right. Oh, so this is Jack from L.A.
Okay, very good.
Hey, Jack.
I thought I would...
Fire question. When ready.
Yeah,
okay.
Go ahead, Jack.
Okay. What do you have any ideas what's at play between a soulful, expressive musician or improviser and one that's technically there but doesn't have the je ne sais quoi?
Ah, okay. So let me ask this. Let me see if I get this straight. So you're trying to get a feel for what's the difference between a very intuitive, creative musician versus one that's just technically really sound and solid but doesn't seem to have that same level of creativity.
Right, right. Or soul,
okay.
Or funky drummers, or, yeah, what, or a lyrical,
what,
yeah.
What is that? Okay.
Yeah.
Well, there are actually two, there's really two potential answers. And the answers are, number one, there is either a difference in the myelin sheath that they have wrapped, and therefore there's actually a difference in their level of skill. And secondarily, there's also a potential difference in their sheer genetic talent for this particular problem. Now, the world will typically overestimate the input from talent, and it will underestimate the input from sheer hard work. This was beautifully explained in a book called The Talent Code by, I believe, I can't remember who wrote it, I think a man named Coyne, Daniel Coyne, I think, might be, I can't remember his first name. But at any rate, the issue is this. So when you're seeing someone that has a smooth capability, you could be looking at someone who is genetically gifted and how that came pretty easily to them, or you could look at somebody who is unbelievably skilled as a result of a tremendous amount of repetition. And the world tends to think that it just arrives in some people. So when I have discussed this before, I inevitably, in fact, what we're going to do is I'm going to walk people through this for people that have never heard it, about the notion of talent, ability, skill, and the myelin sheath. Now, so I want you to picture that the nervous system is constructed in the following way, and this is going to be the reason why I have a great deal of confidence in the answer that I'm giving you. I want you to think about the nervous system is essentially a set of wires, and let's talk about what those wires do so we actually understand the construction of the human body and the purpose of the mind within it. What happens is that the mind's job ultimately is to move the body. That is its purpose. A plant doesn't move, or certain plants have a few stereotypical little movements that they make. but they don't do anything remotely similar to what an animal does. Plants are not able to get up, move around a landscape, and adjust themselves in an infinite variety of fashions in the way that an animal can do. Now, what an animal is doing, so the job of the animal's brain is to coordinate those movements. And the way it coordinates those movements is it actually needs to figure out what movements are going to be the most profitable genetically. In other words, it needs to know, needs to compute and guesstimate which movements will actually result in either increased likelihood of survival or the increased likelihood of reproduction, or both, ideally. So sometimes you can't have both. You have to increase your likelihood of reproduction and at the expense of your survival. So when a tight end in the National Football League in the Super Bowl goes over the middle to catch an important pass, his survival instincts are telling him, you better peek and see whether or not that linebacker is anywhere around you while you reach up and expose your ribs to getting hit for the ball, you know, to get the ball. So his survival instincts are actually in competition with his reproductive instincts that desperately want him to catch this ball so that he can get a ring, so that he can walk into every bar for the rest of his life and say, my genes were at one point demonstrated that they were the best genes on earth, and therefore you should sleep with me. Okay? So he has that conflict inside of his head. So the movements that the organism is attempting to orchestrate are actually they're a cost-benefit analysis of all of the survival and reproductive pluses and minuses that could be associated with the opportunities and threats that the organism is aware of at that particular moment. Now, so the way the organism is hooked up to the world is through the senses. So the sensory system is essentially an input device. So the eyes, the ears, the nose, touch, smell, taste, these are the ways that information comes up into the system, into the brain. The brain then runs spectacularly complex analytics to try to come up with the answer to the question, what is the next best move that we can make that will optimize our gene survival, okay, which is the total cost-benefit analysis of survival and reproductive values that are on the table for what the organism could do something about. The organism then computes what it is that it should be best doing, and in that computation, it doesn't just have the ability to compute, it doesn't have the ability just to sense, it also has the ability to execute behavioral programs. And so the behavioral programs are executed by patterns of nerve impulses that are sent to the motor strip of the brain. They go down the motor strip, down the spinal cord, and they exit in the spinal nerves. As the spinal nerves go out and they attach themselves to the muscles. The muscles are then either contracted or relaxed in extremely sophisticated patterns that allow the organism to move in a coordinated fashion that is the organism's best guess for an idealized movement that at that moment maximizes the impact of its gene survival. Now, a tremendous amount of those movements are natural to the organism. There's already pathways from birth that actually have already encoded how the organism can move. So it doesn't have to learn how to sneeze. It already knows how to sneeze. It doesn't have to learn how to smile. It already knows how to smile. It doesn't have to learn how to laugh. It already knows how to laugh. So there's all kinds of stuff that it already knows how to do, that the pathways are already in there. But it does not know how to play jazz guitar. It does not know how to do a bicycle kick like Pele. It does not know how to dunk a basketball like Jordan. It does not know these things, and it cannot know these things. And the reason why it cannot know these things is for the simple reason that the nervous system has to have and does have within it the way the wires are set up. They're actually set up in an interesting fashion, and I'm going to describe this so that people can get it and understand why there are no prodigies. Okay? So everybody always thinks that there's some prodigy, and I always get, you know, whenever I give this discussion, I get 5 emails saying, what about Mozart? So I'm going to tell about Mozart tonight so that I don't get that email. I'll get an email about somebody else. Okay, now, what's going on here is that you have the ability to imagine what movements that it's going to take in order to imitate what you see in somebody else, or to imagine what it is that you need to do in order to accomplish something. So your brain can figure out that it needs to reach and move its fingers and grasp an apple. So it can understand that it needs to do that in order to bring that apple up to its mouth. Now, it doesn't need to learn that. It intuitively knows how to move to achieve certain behavioral targets. Now, so let's suppose some kid is trying to learn how to play the piano. And the teacher says, I want you to take your pointing finger here, and I want you to go hit this key right here. That's called middle C. So when the kid does it, what we have is an impulse from the motor strip that's running down the spinal cord, exiting the spinal nerve attached to that right finger, and now it's going to contract the muscles and move it down in an imitative fashion, just the way it saw the teacher do it, and it all looks fine. So the kid now knows how to hit middle C with his forefinger. All is well in the world, except that if we actually watch the biophysics of what just took place, we would find that as that nerve impulse left the motor strip, we would find that it would be traveling through the brain and traveling down a neuron that is what we're going to call unmyelinated, which means it has no insulation on it. There are neurons in the brain that are myelinated. Myelin is a little substance. It's like a waxy substance that is wrapped around the neurons. And as the myelin is wrapped around the neurons, then what will happen is a neuron will become insulated. Now, as this kid moves that finger, there's an electrical impulse that is going down that nerve. And the nearby cells called glia, they're called glue, and that's what glia is, or glue in, Latin or whatever it is. Point is that these are supportive cells. They're like scaffolding in the nervous system holding that brain and the nervous system together. And when an electrical impulse goes down a neuron, the glia cells can feel it. And in their DNA, they say, that's kind of interesting. And now let's suppose that kid does it again. And then he does it again, and then he does it again. And the teacher says, keep moving that finger and keep hitting middle C. What will happen is that those impulses will cause those glia cells to actually start to create myelin and wrap themselves around that neuron, and so they're thereby creating insulation. Now, when it creates the insulation, what's going to happen is that thereby nearby nerves, then, when the electrical impulse goes down a myelinated nerve or myelinated axon, electricity is not leaking to the neurons right next to it. Now, the first time when that kid was moving his finger up and down, he was leaking electricity to other neurons that were attached to other fingers that were very nearby. And so when he tried to move that finger, his other fingers wanted to move. So he was clumsy. Okay. Now, and it's also true that because electricity leaked to the nearby neurons and thereby activated other neurons, it is also true that the signal was weaker and slower. So therefore, when the kid tried to move his finger, he moved it slow and he was clumsy compared to his teacher. Okay? But if the child keeps moving that hand over and over and over and over and over and over again, then what will happen is slowly the glia cells will create an insulation of myelin sheath around that neuron. And what will now happen is the electricity will not leak to nearby neurons. The nearby fingers will not want to move when the kid moves that finger. And it will move much faster. And the more that the kid moves that finger, the more myelin will be wrapped. And what's happening is that the brain is effectively sculpting itself into a machine for moving that finger very, very quickly. In fact, it can wrap not just once around that neuron, it can wrap and wrap and wrap and wrap and wrap and wrap and wrap. It can wrap 250 sheets of myelin sheath around that neuron to the point where that neuron is explosively fast, so that as soon as there's a signal from the motor strip to move that finger can move with unbelievable precision, and it can move 100 times faster than it could originally move. This is skill. Okay, you are now looking at what it takes to build a Carlos Santana. Okay, that's what that is. You are looking at a brain that has sculpted itself by wrapping the myelin sheath so that it is unbelievably facile at making those particular muscular contractions. You are not born with this. And anybody that thinks that somebody is born with it is lying, okay, or if they say that they've witnessed it. I've had many mothers tell me that, oh, my child can just sit down and play the piano, never had a lesson. You know, he just can do it. Like hell he can. The truth is that would be impossible. And the reason why it would be impossible is because the brain comes in this manner into the universe without any myelin built in it. Okay? This thing is a block of marble. And the only way to get it to be able to do those things that we're seeing is to wrap the myelin sheath. And the only way the myelin sheath can be wrapped is by repetition. There's no other way to do it.
Uh-huh.
So when we look back and we see a masterpiece, so we see Michelangelo's David, and we look at that thing and we say, oh, my God, how did that guy do it? The answer is, it's simple. He wrapped the myelin sheath. Okay? And the masterpiece is not Michelangelo's David, and it's not the Pietà. The masterpiece was the masterpiece of his mind that Michelangelo built himself. Okay? So whenever you see phenomenal abilities, you are seeing an interaction between two things. Some people, even two people side by side working equally hard, attempting to wrap the myelin sheath as best they can, one of them is a little better. Now, I have to tell you, tonight I was listening on the radio because I'm from Sacramento area, and so I've got a soft spot in my heart for the Sacramento Kings. Now, they're terrible. They keep losing. They haven't been to the playoffs in 10 years. So they make terrible management decisions. What can I tell you? But tonight, they played the Cleveland Cavaliers, and on the other side was LeBron James. And LeBron James was, again, absolutely magnificent. He scored 32 points. He hit 5 3-pointers out of 8 or whatever he did. He was just phenomenal. But you know what? The Kings only lost by 6 points. You realize that was a tie game with a minute to go. The Sacramento Kings were almost as good. Okay, there's a lot of people out there that could play that guitar just about as good as Santana, or maybe better. Okay, you will never hear of those people, and we won't hear about those people because of marketing, luck, all kinds of stuff. So your question, is there any secret sauce? Are there some people that are just magical? And the answer is, yeah, there are. But they didn't get that way by luck. They got that way by... They were naturally a little bit more gifted. So LeBron James is naturally just one notch more gifted than even the elite of the NBA. And he just is. Okay? And so is Michael. And so is Magic. And so is Larry. And that's just the nature. But you know what? There's people, a normal outstanding person that worked like hell was just one tiny, just breathing down their neck. Okay, and so even an average nervous system, if they were determined to do it, could become one hell of a piano player. Now, could they become Scott Joplin? Maybe not. Okay, Liberace? Maybe not. but they could be unbelievably good. And so that's the answer is there a little bit of secret sauce? Yeah, but most of the secret sauce is not a secret. Most of the secret sauce is the time, the energy, the dedication, and the repetition that it takes to build a masterpiece inside your mind.
Wow, yeah. Is there then a difference between a great classical pianist playing a piece but then can't improvise on the spot versus an improvising?
You bet there is. Yeah. So you've wrapped different myelin.
The distinction we – the improvisation is kind of, is it's really –
improvisation is actually myelin sheath.
Yeah.
So when you watch a great basketball player, all you're watching is improvisation of existing myelin sheath. Myelin sheath has wrapped itself into little neural circuits where there's fundamentals that are being executed. So all you're watching is all that a spectacularly complex thing is a bunch of unbelievably simple things that are all put together. And so and they're put together when it's usually really impressive. It's put together with great speed. Now, sometimes it's not put together with great speed. Sometimes it's Michelangelo's David, and he took his sweet time doing it, but he just did it perfectly. Okay? But when we see athletics or we see music, we see improvisation in music, we think we're looking at some magical gift. You're not looking at a magical gift. You're looking at somebody who has wrapped the myelin sheath around a whole bunch of patterns of music and has executed these things over and over and over again. And so on the fly, just like a basketball player who literally doesn't know whether they're going to go to the left or the right 1 second, you know, a millisecond before they make their move, they don't know. It'll depend upon what the defense does, okay? And the only reason they can make that move that quickly is because they have wrapped the myelin sheath and those impulses are going to their muscles 100 times faster than they did when that kid first bounced the ball. Okay?
Jack, thank you very much.
Great question, Jack.
Great question.
Thank you for asking. Thank you for calling. It's a pleasure.
Thank you.
You bet. All right.
Dr. Lyle, you want to take
one
more
and then we'll wrap it up.
All right. One more question. All right.
Yeah.
Dear Dr. Lyle, a long-term listener, and I've stumbled upon a very insightful theory by a Russian evolutionary psychologist and men's rights activist, oh boy, Oleg Novoselov.
Okay.
He suggests that relationships...
Wait, what's the guy's name?
Oleg Novoselov.
Okay, all right.
I wonder if there's a pun there, but I'll leave it to the
I don't know.
Expert.
I'm sure you'll find it. Go ahead, let's see what we got.
Okay, he suggests that relationships naturally progress from courtship to love to something he calls inversion of dominance, when a female takes control and then subsequently loses respect for the male. He suggests that love can only persist if the man continuously resists being dominated and controlled by the woman, but not so much to show that he's totally uncontrollable. In response to this resistance, the woman shifts to the love mode again and repeats the cycle of attempting to invert dominance. My question is, do females naturally attempt to dominate men in long-term relationships? And if so, why do they then lose respect for the man once they succeed? Of course he's Russian, right? Of course this guy's Russian.
Some
parents
disagreeable
are from Russia.
Russian, like,
oh,
got
yeah.
some shrew that I have no idea why this guy came up with this. I think it's hilarious. No, there's no such theory. This is bogus at its root. Now let's try to look and see why there's anything here that old Oleg, you know, was looking at and what he has misinterpreted. It's going to turn out that there is an interesting dynamic between males and females that is very important to understand to know whether or not there's still going to be chemistry flowing in the relationship. This isn't sufficient for chemistry to flow in the relationship, but I believe it's pretty well necessary for this to flow. So what's necessary is that the woman must admire the male as a human. And the male must find the female sexually appealing. So that is a characteristically critical dynamic. The male doesn't have to admire the female in the way that the female ought to be admiring the male. So this is what this guy's calling dominance. I wouldn't exactly call it dominance. However, it's close. Let's talk about what I think the derivatives are that are involved here. You can imagine that if you're a female and you're pregnant, you are wanting this guy to stick around, and you're also you're in a situation where if you're in a pair bond with this guy, which is your best hope for getting a maximum amount of resources from him, you are going to have a bunch of conflicts of interest with him, and you're going to have disagreements about how to manage the challenges of the environment. And so there's going to be discussions, and there's going to be a review of the analysis of what the optimal behavior pattern should be for, quote, us. And there's going to be disagreements. And no matter how happy these guys are with each other as people and as romantic partners, there's still going to be disagreements. Should we go left or should we go right? Should we go east? Should we go west? Should we go south? Should we befriend those people or not befriend those people? You know, should I spend the next 2 days hunting or not spend the next 2 days hunting? There's going to be discussions and an analysis of how to utilize the couple's resources in an optimal fashion. We're going to assume that they're on the same team about how those resources ought to be distributed. So we're not just talking about arguments over laziness and chiseling each other. We're talking about literally teamwork, trying to be yoked together, pulling in the same direction, and trying to survive and reproduce effectively as a team. Now, if it turns out that the male's judgment is not as good as the female's judgment, the female is going to be not happy about this, and she is damn well going to want to dominate those decisions, because she's going to be like, look, fool, the last 4 times we did it your way, and I was sure I was right, 4 out of 4 it turned out, you know, we suffered losses behind your bad judgment. So we're going to do it my way this time. Okay? Now, coincidentally, if she is thinking this and believes it and is experiencing this kind of frustration, do you think that maybe she's less sexually interested? You're damn right she's less sexually interested. He might have been pretty, beautiful man, beautiful body, plays the guitar, but it turns out his judgment is for shit. Okay? And so pretty soon, her sexual hots are dropping. And so this is what Mr. Oleg here is observing, a pattern, but he's not understanding the pattern. Now, so let's look at that female, therefore, as she's watching this judgment that is inferior to her own and therefore does not admire the male as a human. So now what is happening is that she's recognizing, you know what? I am capable of feeling admiration for people. There is some other male for whom I would feel this kind of admiration. And when I feel that admiration, that's a signal down from my genes telling me that I'm a hell of a lot safer than I am when I'm not in a situation where I'm admiring the male. Okay? So the male doesn't need to be, quote, admiring the female, because as the male, he is going to get his way more often when there's conflicts. And the reason why he's going to get his way more often when there's conflicts is because he's not only bigger and stronger and can essentially force the issue if it came to a screaming fight. But the other issue is that he doesn't have as much invested in the offspring. And he can walk away and abandon a relationship with much less cost than the female can. And so it's not that the cost is trivial. He would still have to find another mate, romancer, it's a big hassle. But the bottom line is that the truth is that he has less to lose. So because he has less to lose, he is more likely to walk if it gets to be conflicted and he doesn't like it. Okay? Now, so that being the situation, the female is a little bit stuck there. And so she can be in a situation where she's going to try to get dominance over the decision-making and make the best she can out of the mess that she's in. This is not that she isn't trying to dominate this guy at all. And in situations where females are happy and admiring of their mates and their mates find them sexually attractive and reasonable enough and not they don't have personality conflicts with them, everything is Jake. Okay, those situations, the females do not, quote, try to spontaneously get dominance over the male. Never happens. Okay, so this is a non-theory by some guy that wasn't thinking this thing through very well, but he has recognized a pattern that correlates with things that you actually see. His theory correlates with something that's real, but it isn't the underlying cause. Fair enough.
Yeah, my layman's analysis is maybe he observed very many Russian couples get together, whereas the Russian man would drink, exercise his poor judgment, and the wife would beat him over the head for it.
Am I wrong?
You're not wrong, Walter. You're just an asshole. Okay.
All right. Well, that's enough for one night. That's great stuff, Nate. That's all fun.
All right. Sounds good. So, listeners, we've got two more questions left that we'll go over next week. They're the questions that we got about jealousy. Somebody's brother, he's getting jealous of when his girlfriend, his brother gets jealous when his girlfriend and him hang out. And then the last question is, how much abuse can our bodies take from working so many days, so many hours a week into our 30s, 40s, and 50s? And then we're going to take more questions that we've gotten, that we've received over the last few weeks as well, about advice for women when in a relationship with the unfaithful alpha male that Dr. Lyle described last week, like Arnold Schwarzenegger, and a couple of other ones about that we've gotten in. So again, keep writing in your questions. We will put them on the list, and we're going to get to a bunch of them next week as well. Dr. Lyle, as always, love it, love it, love it.
All right. Good fun, Nate. Thank you.
All right. Have a good night, everybody.
Thanks for listening. If you like what you hear, subscribe, write us a review, or share this podcast with a friend. To send in a question or read more about the show, you can visit our website at www.beatyourgenes.org. Until next time, this is Nate G. and Dr. Lyle with Beat Your Genes, an evolutionary psychology podcast for finding happiness in the modern world.